Welcome to Radio Oldies, sponsored by Baillie Gifford Actual Investors. Looking beyond today's headlines, Baillie Gifford backs exceptional companies driving progress and helping investors benefit from long-term growth.
I'm Charlotte Metcalf, and I'm on the verge of being highly amused for the next half hour or so, as I hope you will be, as I'm in conversation with one of the most outrageously funny women I know, the Australian-British writer Kathy Lett. Kathy's written 20 novels, published in 19 languages around the world, having embarked on her hugely successful writing career in the 70s at the tender age of 17 with her co-authored book, Puberty Blues. Since then, she's continued cheering us up no end with her bawdy puns and general hilarious outspokenness. But beyond that, she's forged a serious political voice for herself and been a consistently powerful advocate for women's rights, and now has a very funny new novel out called The Sisterhood Rules. Kathy Lett, a very warm welcome to Radio Oldie.
No pressure. Now I have to be really funny. My only commandment is thou shalt not bore. So I'll try not to break it today. But thank you for that lovely introduction. That was really nice.
My pleasure. And you are very funny. I don't think you can help it.
But I think women are funny. Very candid, very cathartic, very confessional and hilarious.
I think that's the thing. I think it's the confessional thing, isn't it? Because I don't think men talk that honestly about sex, for example, in the way we do.
Yeah, men would be shocked if they knew how candid women are with each other. And also, you know, it's not just me imagining that women are funny. Anthropologists say that women in all cultures on the planet laugh more often than men, especially in all female groups. So all I do as a writer, I think if I have any strength at all, it's writing down the way women talk when there's no men around. And also maybe putting into words what women are thinking but not necessarily saying out loud. So that's all I do. That's the secret. Yeah.
Well, let's talk about your new book now, The Sisterhood Rules, because it's about two sisters who have fallen out fairly irreparably at the beginning because one has stolen the husband of the other. Mm. Now, you have three sisters. Is anything of this at all autobiographical?
Oh, my gosh. My mother gave me the best gift imaginable, three sensational sisters. Have you got sisters, Charlotte?
No, I haven't. I've got a brother.
But even if you don't have biological sisters, you do have the sisterhood.
Yes.
You have that wonderful group, that female camaraderie, and those wonderful friendships. But the number one rule of the sisterhood is that, you know, husbands come and go, but girlfriends last forever, so never let a penis come between us. And in this book, yes, one of the sisters has stolen the other one's husband. And it's only when their mother goes missing, they're forced to come back together to try and find her. And I wanted to write a book about reconciliation, because first of all, I do have a lot of friends who've fallen out with their siblings or a very close girlfriend, which can be more painful and heartbreaking than a divorce. So, and there's so much disharmony in the world, there's no unity. I think we all have to try in our own lives to patch things up and to make an effort to put some good vibes out in the world, you know. Yeah. So, and I wanted to, not just about the sister, there's sisterhood rules in the book, like, you know, be the wind beneath her bingo wings, you know, be like a big pair of knickers, you've got her ass covered.
Wonder bra. You quite often talk about the wonder bra.
Yeah, like women should be each other's human wonder bras, uplifting, supportive and making each other look better. And I'm wearing a wonder bra now. And it's so cool because when you take it off, you wonder where the hell your tits went. You know, it's also saying to women, think big. So it's full of good sisterhood rules like that. But the main one is love and loyalty. Stick to each other like a nylon dress in a heat wave. Because we've never needed the sisterhood more. If you look at the world at the moment, women's rights are slipping back everywhere.
Correct.
A woman born in America today has less rights than her grandmother. So the abortion bans in America, you know, in the Taliban, women are just they're being erased in Afghanistan. Yeah. In Iran, never has a haircut been so political.
Yeah.
And in our own world, we've got upskirting and, you know, date rape and revenge porn and the manosphere and Andrew Tate and incel and all of that. But I think it is important to remember that the sisterhood is powerful because the Me Too movement started with one tweet and it brought down Harvey Weinstein. of course, with the Epstein files, there's only one person in prison, and it's a woman.
Yes,
she deserves. Outrageous. She deserves to be there, obviously. But why has not one man been held to account? So I think women need to get angry again. Mm. You know, we need to get back to our 70s era where we sort of storm the barricades and say enough, enough already. And men should definitely come and join us. Sometimes men say to me, oh, you feminists want too much, you know. And I'm like, do we? Equal pay, that'd be nice.
Mm-hmm.
We'd like men to help us more around the house, which is, you know, in their interests, as it's scientifically proven no woman ever shocked her husband while it was vacuuming. I always say to men, you know, when they go up to me, oh, what do women really want in bed? I'm like, breakfast. Mm-hmm. Breakfast and a very good book. So, yeah, we'd like men to work out that Mutual Orgasm is not an insurance company. That'd be great. And to talk to us occasionally, you know, because sometimes you think your small intestine communicates with you more often than your husband or your partner. So I don't think that's asking for a lot. Do you?
No.
So come on, guys. Come and fight for us. You know, 100 years since Emily Pankhurst tied herself to the railings and we still don't have equal pay and we're getting concussion hitting our head on the glass ceiling and we're supposed to clean it while we're up there. So... You know, it's enough already. So this book is just, yes, it's the sisterhood rules, but it's also the sisterhood rules. When we stick together, we can make change and we can make the world a better place.
But it's interesting you talk about anger because the protagonist in your new book, who's Isabel, she's very, very angry. Is any of that autobiographical?
No, my sisters, we all get on so fantastically.
What about friends? Have you had a friend?
I've had falling out with friends, yes, I have. I've had two big heartbreaks from women who've... One nicked a bloke, yeah. One nicked a bloke, another one nicked a job.
That's bad.
And they were both very, very close friends, and I lost the friendship. And you know, and I grieved.
Mm.
You do grieve for female friendship because they know you so well.
Yeah.
The intimacy.
The betrayal. There's such
betrayal.
Because you've told them everything.
Everything.
Yeah. Yeah.
So, and it really aches. So I just tapped into a lot of that heartbreak. But with my own sisters, no, they're sensational. But I think it is something women should talk about more, about when sisterhood goes sour. And, you know, in all my novels, 20 novels I've written, this is my 21st, I've always championed women.
Yes.
But you have to admit there are some women who need to go to the vets to get their claws done. but also in the book, you were saying this is the oldie, you know, so we're talking about people of a certain age. And my favourite character in the book is the mother.
Yes.
Because when the sisters come back together to find their mother who's gone missing, they think she's gone to a Dignitas clinic in Switzerland.
She's having rampant sex.
Well, they go rushing there to save her life and they hear these drums in the woods and they think, oh, it's an end-of-life ritual or something. They run down through the woods and there's their mother dancing naked around a fire pit with a 39-year-old alpine horn player. And the mother's my favourite character because her message is that women don't give up sex when we get old. We get old if we give up sex. So her philosophy is never put off till tomorrow anybody you could be doing today.
But do you think that's really interesting you say that? Do you think that's important? Because so many of my friends have lost husbands to younger women.
Ah, right. Well, it is so shocking when that happens. And the worst thing is, I've had women this has happened to as well, and they'll do anything to make themselves look younger.
Yeah.
Right? I don't see them for a while, and then I see these breasts coming down the high street.
Oh, they've Lord. And then you don't see the face behind the plastic.
And then they've got those lips.
Oh, yes.
Those lips, it looks as though she's got a vagina sutured to her face.
Yeah.
Which is basically the collagen. They take the fat out of the body.
No,
inject it into their lips so they're literally talking out of their ass, which says a lot about Hollywood.
Mm.
And then I see them at the gym. This is the weirdest thing, Charlotte. I see them at the gym. And they've waxed all their body hair off.
Mm.
And I'm like, why do you want to look like a prepubescent girl?
Yeah.
You know, I like a man who likes a little like bushwalking. I mean, I like a man who likes a little bit of bush tucker, basically. So I'm against cosmetic surgery. Mm. I think, you know, my mother told me never to pick my nose, especially from a catalogue, ha, ha, ha. But why can't men just learn to read between my lines? It's all there, the books, the babies, the hours of fun-loving flirtation.
It's the map to your soul.
It's a map to your soul. Mm. And also, why would you want a man who only wants you because you're silicon from tonsils to toenail. You wouldn't want a guy like that. And also, the statistical evidence of older men running off with younger women is static. It's been the same forever. But the evidence of older women running off with younger men is on a skyrocket trajectory.
Is that right? Oh, tell us.
Well, younger men, first of all, the reason they love older women, we don't want babies.
No.
We know ourselves very well. I mean, good sex is about being relaxed in your skin.
Yeah.
And by this age, women know what we want and we're not afraid to ask for it. I also think, and taking a sexual survey of all my female friends, I do all my research in in-depth scientific fashion over cocktails with girlfriends, but they all report that their orgasms are longer and stronger post-menopause.
This is what...
I mean, my whole literary raison d'etre now is to say to women, have a sensational second act. Go forth and be fabulous. Because once you've cut the psychological umbilical cord that kept you tethered to the kitchen by your heart and your apron strings, you can put yourself first for the first time in your life. Adventure before dementia is my motto. And I'm not that I'm making light of that terrible disease, but you never know what fate's got in store.
No.
So carpe the hell out of DM. Carpe diem like there's no tomorrow. And I know that we have this ageist sexism is sewn into our psyche, that a woman our age is dismissed as a hag, a bag, a crone, whereas guys get to be the silver fox.
Yes.
We're told what we can wear, what we can't wear, mustn't show a décolletage, mustn't show our upper arms.
Upper arms, I know.
The right to bear arms, I say, Charlotte. Look at Mick Jagger. He's wearing trousers so tight you can detect his religion. And nobody ever comments that he's too old to wear what he's wearing.
Well, Mick Jagger is, I would say he's fairly exceptional, having watched him run backwards very fast.
But do you know what I mean? The fashion police are not issuing edicts about what they can and can't wear. So I also am aware of the fact that once you get over 50, men try to put you out to career pasture. You're told told you've passed your amused by date.
Yes.
And part of the trouble is we never see women who look normal, like you and me, with our wrinkles and crinkles and our happy grey hair or whatever. 85% of people on British television over 50 are men. The women just get disappeared and sidelined. And it's not just me imagining that we get the cloak of invisibility draped on our shoulders. Some years ago, MI5 said they wanted to employ middle-aged women as spies because nobody sees us.
Because we're so invisible.
But I'm like, if they're going to give us the cloak of invisibility, are we going to use it for good or for evil? I'm thinking evil, Charlotte. I'm thinking mischief. I mean, I want to say to women, just do something outrageous every day. Be loud, be seen, be wicked, be wild. You know, why not?
The Oldie is a huge fan of Hebridean Island cruises. Their small ships carry between just 38 and 48 guests around the Scottish islands, lochs and coastlines. They specialise in exploring the secret corners of Scotland's west coast aboard two small ships, Hebridean Princess with 48 guests and Lord of the Highlands with just 38. It's less cruise ship, more country house party at sea. Excellent food, remarkable scenery and a wonderfully civilised atmosphere. To discover more and get savings of up to 20%, visit hebridean.co.uk or search Hebridean Island Cruises.
I mean, I think it's interesting what you say about women. I'm just thinking about news presenters, and if you think of how many elderly male news presenters there are, and there have been elderly women news presenters, but they're all so ravishingly beautiful. I'm thinking Anna Ford, Selena...
Scott.
You know, they're all... You know, Angela Rippon, they were all absolutely drop dead.
And there's not that many of them compared to
the men. No, they're not. And they're all gorgeous.
So I'm afraid we suffer from facial prejudice. We get judged on our looks in a way that men don't, which is very annoying. But, you know, dimmer switch, greatest beauty aid known to womankind. I just keep the lights low. And it's fine.
Candlelight. I'm very keen on candlelight.
Candlelight. The book before this I wrote called The Revenge Club, which is about four middle-aged women who take revenge on the men who sabotage their careers for the crime of being menopausal. When I went to my publisher with that idea, he said, oh, nobody wants to read about middle-aged women. They're just not sexy.
Is that what he actually said?
Mm-hmm. And a worse comment I got from another publisher. Another publisher said to me, oh, middle-aged women are like Sudan and Mogadishu. We know they exist, but... but nobody wants to go there. And then my publisher dropped me after 20 novels. He dropped me. And that's what I'm saying about women not getting their book contracts. And I must admit, Charlotte, for a minute I lost my mojo and I thought maybe I have passed my amused by date. But then, you know, I'm a feisty Aussie Sheila. I just thought, nah, no way. I looked around my own friends who were all swinging off a chandelier with a Tory boy between their teeth. I thought, these women are wonderful. I want to write about them because, you know, women this age, we have such a vast hinterland. We've raised the children. We've had the careers, the breakups, the betrayals, the breakdowns, the divorces. We've looked after the aged parents. You know, we've done so much and we know so much. I love writing about women this age. So I just got a new agent, new publisher, and the revenge
that
card.
Bit, how difficult was that?
Well, it wasn't as hard as I thought. I just had to find the right people. And then as soon as the Revenge Club came out, it went to number one in Australia, which was the best revenge,
you
know?
Brilliant, yeah.
So who do they think's reading books? It's women our age.
Yes, correct, yeah.
And whenever you read about women our age in books, they're invariably, you know, lonely and depressed and they wilt away in their flats and get eaten by their cats.
Yeah, like, it's all passion spent.
Like Anita Bruckner books are like that.
Yes, yeah.
And we're not like that.
No.
You know, we're in our prime. We're fabulous. So that's what I want to do. I want to get a new literary genre.
Uh-huh.
Because
I kind of
accidentally invented chick lit. I hate that term. It's so patronizing.
Yes, it is, yeah.
You know, a man who writes first-person funny comedic novels would get, like Nick Hornby gets compared to Chekhov, whereas we get kind of Chekhov. You get a pink cover with a cupcake on it, whatever.
Pink cover, yeah, I know, bloody book covers, yes.
But if you think, you know, I was writing Puberty Blues in the 70s and then all the books I was writing in the 80s, I kind of kick-started that genre. And then I did kick-start Mummy Lit as well with Fiddle Attraction, Mad Cows, Nip Lit with Nip and Tuck. And I thought, what's a genre for women our age right now? And I was talking this with my sisters and we came up with I don't give a shit lit.
Isn't that great? Now, you mentioned Puberty Blues, so let's go back to your beginnings a minute, because you wrote that at... Tell us 17. How all that happened, because it's all to do with surfing in Australia.
Yeah.
Tell our listeners.
Well, the boys I grew up with in Australia disproved the theory of evolution. They were evolving into apes. And they were so sexist, Charlotte. They used to get us to cut their names out in paper, sticky tape them to our stomachs, and then sunbake, so we get a tan tattoo in the shape of their names. So
Did you do that?
Well, it was a man's world. We were 13, 14, 15. We did what the boys wanted. But if I ever get cancer, I'll have a melanoma called Bruce. I'll have to have a Bruceectomy to get rid of it, you know? There were also the sort of guys who thought sex drive meant doing it in the car. I don't know. Where do English women lose their virginity? Did you lose your virginity in the car?
I've just got to think about it.
Oh, my God. Cast your mind back, darling.
A very long time ago, I'm sorry to say.
Well, in Australia, every woman I know lost a virginity in a car. I'm making light of it because it was a very brutal, sexist world, the surfy world. And the girls were just really a life support system to a pair of breasts. We weren't allowed to surf. We had to sit on the beach and fetch the Chico roll and massage the male ego and mind the towel. We wore these tiny, tiny little bikinis, like, and all day you'd be glancing down nervously in case something had escaped. It gave bad hair day a whole new meaning, you know. And Germaine Greer was rhyming slang for beer. We knew nothing about feminism.
No.
But then I was a surfy girl from 13 to 15, but by about 15, I started to sort of see through it. Because my mother was a teacher, a headmistress, she was had a vocation, that was her total passion, was her work, three fabulous sisters. So I got some objectivity. And so I wrote that book for the other surfy girls, just to say to them, you are more than just a... You know,
and your friend, you did it with a friend.
I did it with a surfy girlfriend, yeah, which was great. He's talking about the sisterly camaraderie. Would I have done it without, if I hadn't had a sounding board like that? And I might have, I would have done it, but probably a little bit later. And the book, but
it took off completely. So tell our listeners about how you were absolutely shot into the stratosphere.
Well, I remember when I was writing the book, because I left home at 16. When I started writing the book, I was living in Sydney in a squat, singing as a busker on the streets, you know. And I went home to see Mum and said, look, I'm writing this book. It's a little bit racy. do you want me to use a nom de plume? She said to me, oh, Kathy, darling, don't worry. I don't think that book's ever going to be published. I mean, I was 17. But, of course, I went from non-entity to overnight notoriety.
Who picked it up? I mean, what brave person picked that book up?
Well, talking about the patriarchy, it was rejected by 9 publishers. Mm-hmm. And then I read an article in the paper by a wonderful feminist called Anne Summers, and she was writing about gang rape in Queensland. And I thought, she'll understand what I'm writing about. And I sent it to her, and she sent it to a very small feminist publishing house in Melbourne called McPhee Gribble. And they got it, and they published it. And then, of course, it just went off. And, you know, my poor parents. Mum said she got so many anonymous phone calls, which was the trolling of its day.
Oh, yeah.
Where they, you know, these heavy breathing men saying, you call yourself a headmistress when you've raised a slut like that.
Yes,
you
know?
Because it sent seismic shockwaves through the community. But it became a cult book, you know. It's been a TV series, it's been a movie. Every Australian kid knows this book. So, yeah. But then I thought, what a great way to earn a living, you know, being a writer. You can work in your jammies all day. You can drink heavily on the job. You can have affairs and call it research. So I thought, I might just keep writing.
Yeah. But you didn't write another book for a while because you went into telly for a bit and met your first husband. So...
I did. I married this lovely guy called Kim Williams, who's now the chairman of the ABC. He was the chairman of Reuters. I've had lovely husbands, actually. Yeah, really good. 2 so far. 2 alpha men, and now I've got a beta boyfriend, which is great. But, yes, I married him, and then it was a very sexist world I was in, though. This is the early 80s. And I had a column in the newspaper, and I already had this hugely successful book out. And I got asked by a television station to come and audition to work as an on-screen presenter with Janet Street Porter.
Gosh, I used to work for her.
Did you? Mm. Well, she went out to Australia to do kind of comedy.
Did she?
And she was going to do the English version of looking at Australian life, and I was going to do be the Australian sort of comic voice. But this was my job interview, Charlotte. I went to chat this channel. There were 5 TV executives sitting in a semicircle. One of them slapped $10 on the table and said, oh, I bet I can make your tits move without touching them. And
no.
I was like, yeah. And I was like, oh, yeah, well, whatever. He leant over, mauled my breasts and said, ha ha, you won, there's the $10. So I said, I bet you $20 I can make your balls move without touching them. And I kicked him between the legs. And when he was in agony, the other guys, killing themselves laughing, got the job. But, I mean, today you'd have a sexual harassment suit.
Yes.
But we had nothing like that. There was no HR.
No, we had nothing. That was part of the course.
Part of the course.
I mean, it's really interesting talking to young people today. And, oh, you know, somebody touched me. And you go, where? Well, on my knee or something. Is that all?
Yeah. But we had to.
We grabbed the whole time, yeah.
But we had to. Every day I went to work, I felt I was strapping on a bulletproof bra before I went into the TV station because... They would, the barbed comments, the sexist comments, and we'd be rated on how rootable we were, meaning how shaggable we were.
Yeah.
But I just turned the tables. I would just, I started doing it to them. And it taught me to back comments back and to be quick-witted. Like, no misogynist can take me down now because I'll be straight back at him. And I always think if you are out with and there's a misogynist there, an Andrew Tate type, and he's putting you down. If you can make people around him laugh at his expense, you've completely nuked his power.
Did you see the Manosphere documentary?
Yes, I did.
Louis III?
And I love Louis. He's a friend of mine, but I thought he was maybe out of his depth on this one.
Yeah.
But still, it was good that men actually got a glimpse into that world because I think they have no idea what their sons are, what's sort of warping their sons' brains, and they have to actually... take more notice of that and counteract it.
Can we talk a bit about your son, actually?
Yes.
Because you've been so moving. I've seen so many interviews with you when you've talked about him.
Mm,
because he's autistic and you have to look after him. Does he live with you?
He's got a little flat, like a bedsit, but he comes back here. I was talking earlier about women cutting the psychological umbilical cord.
Yes.
I will never really be able to do that.
No.
But things have got better. I mean, when Jules was diagnosed, he's 35 now.
And a successful actor.
Yes, although he's an unemployed actor now, tautology. obviously. But when he was diagnosed at three, that was a diagnosis that dragged you down into the dark, you know, the A word.
Yes.
And I think and there'll be a lot of people listening who've got a child on the spectrum or a sibling or a grandchild.
Yes, yes.
And who will relate to this, that, you know, when you first get the diagnosis, you go into denial. I mean, you just bankrupt yourself seeing every medical expert yeah. on the planet. And then you go through a horrible stage of feeling guilty. You know, your guilt gland throbs. You're like, was it something I ate? Was it something I drank? Oh, was it that one glass of wine in the final trimester? If only I'd feng shuied my aura like Gwyneth Paltrow, you know, all would be fine. Then you probably feel a bit sorry for yourself and you go through a stage of drinking probably a little bit too much Chardonnay. And then eventually you just start to think, well, this is the unique little person I've been given and I've got to do my best by them. It's a lifelong neurological condition. Its chief characteristics are an inability to communicate and socialise, often chronic OCD and anxiety, but also often a very high IQ. I mean, yeah. Jules is like Wikipedia with a pulse on his subjects. No one knows more about tennis and movies and things like that. So what he's taught me is that a label is just something, you know, yes. on the side of a jam jar. If we could just all learn to think outside the neurotypical box and give these kids a chance to shine, you know, they could contribute to society in the most wonderful ways. But sadly, less than 15% of people with autism are in the workforce, which is a much lower inclusion rate than other disabilities. So... But, you know, we now know with diagnostic hindsight that Mozart and Einstein and Orwell and Van Gogh and Steve Jobs and all these amazing artists and scientists and musicians were on the spectrum. So, wow, what an amazing gift they have.
I think you're right to say stop boxing people in with labels because there's far too much of that going on.
Yeah, there is.
I mean, there's so many young people now saying, I've got anxiety.
I know.
And who doesn't? I mean, everyone's anxious all the time when you're young and at school.
Well, especially now.
Yeah.
In this crazy world we're living in.
It's not an affliction. It's normal.
It's normal. Yeah, it's becoming a bit like psychological hypochondria.
Yes.
That everybody's got something. Look, a diagnosis is a psychological signpost. Like, it will point you in the right direction to get some help if you need it. But it shouldn't box you in either. Like, when, as I said, we need to think outside the neurotypical box. Anyone who is raising a child or a grandchild on the spectrum, you develop a very dark sense of humour. And, you know, and what's so funny about people on the spectrum, they have no filter.
Yes.
So they say whatever they're thinking. The best example I can give of this, and I have many, but when Jules was about 13 or maybe about 13, I think, I took him to a charity event in Downing Street. And I introduced him to the then Prime Minister, Tony Blair. And I said, oh, Jules, this is the Prime Minister, Tony Blair. And Jules just looked at him and said, oh, yes, you're the one my mother calls Tony blah, blah, blah. Okay. And I'm going, who is this child and why is he calling me mother, you know? And it was just so mortifying, you know. And then I took him to another charity event and he met Anne Widdecombe. And I remember, I said, Jules, oh, this is the Minister, Anne Widdecombe. And he said, Oh yes, you're the one my mother says is two-faced. But if so, why are you wearing that one when it's all wrinkly and crinkly and old?
Is that what he said? Oh my goodness.
I'm just wishing I lived in an earthquake zone. But then again, Charlotte, when you think we're living in a society where everybody lies to us, Trump lies, hemorrhages lies all day, to have someone who just tells you the truth... It's a very rare commodity. I'm thinking of putting him in a truth booth where people pay to come in and say, does my bum look big in this? Well, yes, it does, or whatever it is. I must be able to make money out of him, Charlotte, somehow.
And tell us about your daughter, because you had two children with your husband.
Jeff Robertson, You've got to remember, once you get through the horror of the divorce, and I don't think divorce is a failure. I just think it's a change.
Yeah.
You know, from honeymoon to tomb can be a long time.
I couldn't agree with you more.
It could be 60, 70, 80 years.
I think it's all misguided.
Yeah, all misguided.
The idea of one man for life. Yeah. It's just, that's not going to work.
But you've got to remember there's something about that person you love.
Yes.
And lean into that, because it's better for everybody if you can stay friends. And also, you've got so much shared history. You don't want to lose that person who's had all those adventures with you, you know. Our daughter is divine. She's in her early 30s. She works for the... She's a... She's... Remember West Wing?
Yes.
Remember CJ?
Yeah.
She's like CJ Tower Hamlets, for the mayor of Tower Hamlets. And she's an activist, and she's passionate, and she's political, and she's fun, and I'm so proud of her, and she's so bright. But, you know, when I've written about raising a teenage daughter, too, which is very, very challenging.
Hello.
I mean, hello. I wrote about that in Into Love, Honour and Betray. Because, I mean, for anyone listening who's got a teenage daughter, it's like living with the Taliban. You're not allowed to laugh, sing, dance. And one day I was going out. I knew she wouldn't approve of my short pink leopard skin miniskirt. So I sneaked down to the front door, you know, and I thought, I'll just creep out so she won't hear me. And I opened the door, and then I hear, she came running down the stairs behind me, and she goes, "What are you wearing? Go back to your room. You're not going out dressed like that." And I remember saying, "But surely I can wear a short skirt. My legs are okay." And she said, "No, it's not the legs, Mum. The skirt doesn't go with your face."
Oh, ouch.
But they definitely come through it.
Yeah, like, they do. They do come through it.
And I'm best friends with her now. I adore her. And we're just on the same page with everything. And she's so much fun.
So what about man number three, who you famously said beta is better?
A beta male adores you, doesn't bore you, and does all your chores for you. They put you on a pedestal and then they polish it for you. So at this stage of my life, it's perfect for me right now. It's just so wonderful.
And you picked him up in the park.
Oh, it's ridiculous, Charlotte. It's so embarrassing. You know, I write these books that are, you know, acerbic and sardonic and, you know, snappy dialogue, bitchy dialogue. But in my own life, I've had, like, I think they call it in the movies a cute meat or a meat cute.
Richard Curtis, basically, you've done in your...
A rom-com, yeah. I was just in the midst of my divorce, and I was jogging through Regent's Park, and Brian was playing Bach in the park. He's a classical guitarist. And he was, it was a hot day, so he'd come out of his flat to practice in the park. He was sitting under a tree, and I just heard this exquisite Bach prelude. And I stopped and listened, and then just went over and told him how beautiful the music was. And then he spoke to me in this lovely Irish accent, you know, and I'm like, "Oh, take me, I'm yours," you know. So, yeah. And, you know, so, yeah, we just had a coffee and we started talking. We just couldn't stop talking. So, I'm lucky. And I do say to women, there's a lot of great men out there. Like, all you hear about is the man drought.
No, there's a lot of men out there, yeah.
You know, and you keep thinking that, you know, women are taught to think that the only, over a certain age, the only time you'll ever be naked in front of a stranger again is when you're in the morgue with a tag on your toe. It's not true. Just be open to, you know, to new, to just be, say yes, be open. Just meet people and laugh and have fun and be yourself. Don't try and change. And, you know, there is love in later life. Yeah.
I think it goes back to the beginning of our conversation where women, older women, aren't confident enough yet to get over the myth that all men only like women much younger, because so many of them have been scarred by being left for younger women.
Yeah, yeah.
So it's very hard for them to believe that they're still desirable.
Well, and of course they totally are, because as I said earlier, they are in their sexual prime. Mm. So, yeah, and... Another thing we should be talking about is the orgasm gap.
Yes.
Because all the research, not only do we have the gender pay gap and also the domestic gap at home where women are doing 99.9% of all the housework and all the childcare, but also there's this orgasm gap that the heterosexual women have one orgasm for every five enjoyed by a heterosexual male. But I think why women are having better sex at this age, why we're putting the sex into sexagenarian, is that we are more confident. I mean, as I said earlier, we know what we want and we're not afraid to ask for it. And men like that.
Yeah.
You know, men, younger men particularly like that. So, you know, we can go into Mrs. Robinson mode. She was only 32 or something, which is so outrageous.
And Bancroft, it doesn't really get any more beautiful on the planet, does it?
And also we have to fight the horrible stereotypes out there, because, you know, women still get judged for having a younger man. I mean,
yes, it's true.
Look at Brigitte Macron.
Yes.
They have a 23-year age gap, I think. Mm. Exactly the same age gap as Trump and Melania. Well, no one ever comments about that. There's still this idea that it's not natural and it's outrageous. But, of course, sexually it makes sense. Men reach their sexual prime at about 20 and women at about, you know... 60. So, 20 goes into 60, a hell of a lot more than 60 goes into 20, as a man. So, yeah, I think we need to, it's time we tore up that tragic trope.
Well, that's very exciting and encouraging for all our women listening.
Yes.
But what are you going to be writing about next, Kathy? What's your next book? Have you started it?
Well, I definitely want, there's such, as I said earlier, this massive hinterland of experiences that women our age have. So I want to write more in the genre of, I don't give a shit lit. But I think it might also be time to do my memoir. Well, I can remember it. So I'm thinking about doing that, writing about how I became a feminist, all the stages of my life. And the best bit, I can't wait to write about what it was like coming to England and all that sort of condescension and everything I got from
Why did you come here?
I fell in love. I fell in love with Jeff, and so
you met him in Australia.
Yes, he had a television show there called Hypotheticals, where he'd take a hypothetical situation, cast it with prime ministers and politicians and various people, and play out the scenario. And so I met him live to air. It's ridiculous to have our first meeting on television. You can see us falling in love.
What were you doing? What?
I was the comic voice. I was there as a young feminist.
Mm-hmm.
Putting the feminist perspective. I was seated between two old, dinosaurs.
Trusters.
Political dinosaurs. So I came here for love. But I landed kind of smack bang in the middle of the sort of literati world. And
when
at
was
that time, this is in 88.
88.
And they were so, a lot of those men particularly had been at Oxford for so long they had ivy growing up the backs of their legs.
Yeah.
And what they graduated in was advanced condescension, especially when it came to Australian women.
It's a very big, heavy-hitting time for male novelists, the 80s. We had Martin Amis, we had Salman
Rushdie,
we had D.M. Thomas.
Julian Barnes.
And
they were so awful to me. I remember one guy, I was at a Times Literary Supplement party with Jeff, and this one critic who was, big noting himself, dropping his own name. He said that something was condescending. He turned to me and said, condescending, it means talking down to. And they would also put me down because of Australia's penal past. But then I'd say what my grandma told me when I said to her I was moving to the UK. She's like, oh, Kath, you can't possibly go and live in London. That's where all those terrible convicts come from.
That's really funny.
And they had absolutely no reply. And then in the end there was a kind of grudging respect, I suppose, because it took me a while to realise that the English didn't like me. So when they used to say to me, are you Australian, so refreshing, I thought, they really like me. I didn't know that refreshing means rack off you loudmouth colonial nymphomaniac. But then after a few years of me not caring and just carrying on being myself, a friend of mine was going to the Royal Polo and rang me up and said, would I like to go? And as a writer, you never turn down an adventure. You're always in Margaret Mead mode.
Was this? Calgary or somewhere?
It was in Wales, in Wales. I can't remember the name of it now. And I was like, sure. So Clarence House saw my name on the list and rang me up and said, as I was going, did I want to present the cups to the princes? They were obviously very low on celebrities that day, like Zed low. I was like, sure. When I got to the polo, the organiser was so furious that they'd asked an Australian woman, to give the prizes. He's one of those guys who sent his shirts out to be stuffed, one of those guys. He was looking down his nose at me, and I said, well, what do I do? And he said, well, as the princes approach, you kiss them on the cheek and present the cup. So I could see Prince William walking towards me, and he looked so bored. I thought I might as well have some fun. So I said, apparently I've got to kiss you. Do you want tongue? And Prince William went, perhaps later. And he went back and told Harry, and I could see Harry killing himself laughing. These are the days when Harry was fun, just before he met Meghan. And he came up and I said, do you want tongue? And he's like, oh, yeah. We had a pash and I jumped on his back and rode him around the paddock. And we had the best time. It was hysterical. And I think they were so relieved not to be treated like porcelain princes.
Yes, yes.
And have some fun. And if they were ever going to put me in the tower, that was the time. And they didn't. And that's when I finally realised that, being yourself
pays off. You had a good lawyer.
Off. I had a good lawyer. I was travelling. That's why I did. Yeah. And I felt a bit of a frisson with old Harry.
Ooh,
I forget he lost his virginity to an older woman. Remember in a paddock or something?
Yeah.
So I thought if I'd played my cards right, I could have married into the royal family the show.
Well, what a note to end on, Kathy.
Oh, I'm just so glad. Did you like the Sisterhood Rules?
I loved it. It really made me laugh.
Oh, I'm so glad. Yeah. Have you ever needed a laugh more?
No, it's very good. All your best puns came out. I would be shaking my head going, I can't believe you just got away with that.
Well, you know, have we ever needed a laugh more?
No, it is really.
If laughter is the best medicine, I'm like, hook us up intravenously, you know. But it's fun, but I hope it's also got a good, strong message of sisterly solidarity.
It has, yeah.
You know, to be each other's human wonder bras. And you've been my human wonder bra today, so thank you.
Oh, well, thank you, Kathy, very much.
Such a pleasure. You're a treasure.
You've been listening to me, Charlotte Metcalf, in conversation with Kathy Lett. If you've enjoyed listening to us and would like to hear more like this, please go to theoldie.co.uk, where you'll also be able to subscribe to the magazine. Meanwhile, my very warm thanks again to you, to Kathy, to Bailey Gifford for sponsoring us, and to you for listening. Goodbye.
This week's podcast was kindly sponsored by Bailey Gifford, actual investors who take a long-term approach to investing in exceptional companies.